Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In Mary Kay Zurovlev's new novel, Man Alive, it all begins with a coin dropped into a parking meter and a bolt of lightning. And Owen Lerner and his family are changed forever. Lerner is an in-control pediatric psychiatrist. He survives lightning striking the coin, but in so doing, now views his life very differently. And life's focus now is on barbecue. For his wife and three kids, what seemed to be a perfect family is not so much anymore. Zurovlev says Man Alive is about how much a member of a family is allowed to change and the limits to that change. Mary Kay Zurovlev is the author of three novels. The Bowl Is Already Broken drew on her long experience as a writer and editor at the Smithsonian's Freer and Sadler Galleries. And her first book, The Frequency of Souls, won the James Jones First Novel Award. Zurovlev is a Oklahoma native and will be the guest of Book Smart Tulsa tonight for a Book Smart Tulsa barbecue, along with authors Rilla Askew and Constance Squires. They'll all be reading from their most recent works. And the event takes place tonight at 6 o'clock at Harwelden. Mary Kay Zurovlev's new novel is titled Man Alive. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Mary Kay Zurovlev, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, Man Alive, it's really interesting because you take what looks to be at the surface a picture-perfect family, you know, working professionals, kids on the college track, and then there's this incident, which we'll talk about in a moment, and their lives utterly change. And maybe, as I was reading through it, my thought was, you know, we see this perfect family, and maybe they were never perfect to begin with, but there was this wonderful facade that was in place. And, of course, the event is Owen Lerner, the therapist, father, patriarch of the family, is struck by lightning and survives.
Yeah. He's hit bad. As he's putting a quarter in the parking meter their last night at the beach, he is struck by lightning.
Now, how did you get that idea? What was the inspiration for making that the fulcrum of the story?
I was playing with an Oliver Sacks piece in the New Yorker about a doctor. He wrote about a doctor and many other people struck by lightning. But the doctor in his piece hears piano music, and he goes off to learn how to compose piano music, and many other things happen. So that's nonfiction. And I'm a fiction writer, so I just close the magazine, and I'm sort of, it's like jazz. You just riff on these things that you see around you. And I thought, oh, pediatric psychopharmacologist is struck by lightning, and all he wants to do is barbecue. Yeah.
So barbecue becomes this focus. Now, there's really interesting, your prose in the book sort of alludes to the idea of burn, fire, moving through his body. And so he comes out of it, and what does he want to do? He wants to be man with fire, grill meats.
Yeah, and so that's one of the questions that you're sort of reading for is it just that he smelled what he smelled as he was being hit? Or is he becoming this primitive person? I mean, he treats kids with all of the issues that are of our day, ADHD and Asperger's and autism, and now he has those symptoms. But he's not so eager to pursue the normal that he once pursued, and that's kind of what you're reading for. What is the new normal?
Right, and that is the great irony of this piece is here he's been treating all these kids. He's exhibiting all the symptoms, and he's almost reveling in them.
Yes, and that was the exciting, that's when it went from a short story. I don't know if you have many people who write short stories on the show, but that's when it went from a short story to a novel. So the notion, that premise that I said to you is almost a comic notion, and I was writing it as a, not a joke, but a short story is sort of one arrow sent to a target. But a novel is many, many, many arrows, and they cluster around the target. And when I started doing the research on lightning and saw that he would have the symptoms he's been treating, then I thought, okay, this isn't a short story. There's a lot more going on here.
Obviously, you had to do a little bit of research. What happens to people that are struck by lightning and usually and survive for whatever reason?
I mean, well, think about it. It's like an electrical storm in your head, and so many.
And what are we made up of? But electrical impulses.
Yeah. There you go. I'm kind of obsessed with electricity.
Why is that?
That's a good question. My first novel was about a couple of electrical engineers and
one woman
using electricity to listen for evidence of life after death. Then I took a turn and wrote about Asian art for the second novel, and now I'm back to electricity, and I just find it fascinating.
Well, the description.
And that you said, all we are is electrical impulses.
Well, the description you have of Owen as he's struck by lightning was really interesting because it was almost like an ocean of light and fire going through him.
Mm.
All your imagery suggests water in an interesting way, I thought.
Yes, he's carried. He's carried along by it. And you know what? Nobody in his family, I mean, this man is really injured. And so they cannot even wrap their minds around the idea that this was in any way an ecstatic experience for him or that he would want to dwell there. Who would want to stick around for that kind of pain? But if you take the pain out of the equation, he really feels like he put it all together. You know how you have those fleeting moments when everything makes sense? And that's what that electrical shock did to him. And in fact, people talk about that, that when all your neurons fire at the same time, you sort of get all sorts of things, or you think you do.
Yeah, that's. I understand pharmaceuticals can do that too, but
exactly.
But the feeling the feeling goes away the next morning.
But he asked that, you know, is he going to be chasing this, and is he going to use drugs to chase this? Is he going to use pain to chase this? Should he chase this? And his wife, just all she wants is for him to get back in the doctor's office and see patients again. And kids want their parents to return to whatever they were. So, you know, that's what everybody wants. And he's really, the question of the book is, how much are you allowed to change within your family unless you don't want to be in that family anymore?
That is a good question. I mean, that seems to be Owen's place is, you know, everybody wants things back to normal. But how can, when something like this happens, how can you ever go back to normal? I mean, it could be a bolt of lightning, as it is in this book, but it could be a trauma. It could be a life-changing event. You're never back to normal.
Exactly. And so, in fact, one of the visual metaphors I had in my head was that, like, when you set up a pool table and then you break and all the balls go scattering, that's what that bolt of lightning is for this family. They are close. You're right in your question. They are close, and they are also, there are fissures between them. And that lightning brings it out. I mean, every family is like that. And the book is told in what I'm calling family point of view. So you're hearing from each person in their head. But we don't share so much one to another, it turns out. Or I don't think we do. And so you know exactly each person's narrative, but they're not necessarily telling the person next to them what's going on in their head.
So describe the Lerner family. We have Owen, who is this pediatric psychotherapist who's struck by lightning. He has a very lovely wife, Tony, who seems to be very devoted for him. And I really love the scenes where I think you're describing how she loves him. But when they go to Rehoboth Beach, which they've been doing their entire life, she says, "I always fall in love with him again," which that's a very nice thought, I thought.
Yeah, and that's just where he can really be himself. I mean, there aren't patients calling every minute, right? And he can really be with the kids and dedicate himself to the kids. And that, and it's just that feeling of the beach as kind of your raw emotion. He also lets himself go. He says 3 weeks of bacon and booze for a vacation from himself. And she does. She falls in love with him again every summer. So she has a very powerful job herself. She is a headhunter for college presidents. And it takes two incomes where they live to keep things going. They've got two boys who've graduated from high school. They're identical twins, and now they're in colleges, Penn and Duke, and a daughter who's 16 who's still in high school. And, you know, she's just always thinking about, she keeps the list of the family's expenses and the family's errands. That's what she does. And now everything is thrown into the air.
Now, the kids, I mean, the idyllic way you sort of depict this family is as they're driving around the beach, they're helping the youngest daughter prepare for her college boards by throwing out the most fancy $10 words, you know, vocabulary out there to quiz her. And this is the sort of family it is. It's a very achievement-oriented family.
Yeah, and they're sort of, the older brothers are kind of helping her and kind of teasing her and kind of taunting each other. Do you know this word? Do you know this word?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what happens. You're tested on those words. I mean, think of a spelling bee. Nobody uses those words in real life. But this is how we gauge achievement. And that kind of ties into what happens to Owen and his rethinking. How do we gauge achievement in our kids? And what does it mean to function within a classroom, within a work environment, within a family?
Mm. Now, in the case of the two twins, they're very achievement-oriented. But once this event happens, all of a sudden, they make big changes in their life, and we meet Will, who's, it was interesting because these twins have sort of a sibling rivalry, even though they're very close, as most twins are. But I love the one twin's description. Will is, I guess, the slightly older one by a couple of minutes.
Yeah, just by minutes.
And he always he describes Ricky and his relationship is that Ricky was uses a mathematical term. He's either slightly less than or equal to. And then Ricky is the person who responds when Owen is hit by lightning, and all of a sudden Will is rethinking that whole relationship.
Isn't that, I mean, so the idea that birth order in that situation would make such a difference. You know, he imagines that he's always been kind of looking out for Ricky and that he's kind of been Dad's favorite. And so when Ricky revives his dad, he thinks, fine, now you guys go at it. And he thinks of himself as off the hook. He can now really be who he is. He doesn't have to have this shadow. But it completely unmoors him.
And Will, you know, it really is a kind of a dutiful first son sort of relationship. All of a sudden, he's seeking out the old family girlfriend and is still a virgin in college, and yet he has his first sexual experience, and that just sort of opens up a lot of doors for him when he goes back to college.
And some very dangerous doors.
Yes, exactly.
You know, he makes a lot of bad decisions, and that's another question about, like, even when we're really far apart from each other, how much are we holding each other in a net? I mean, I'm thinking about the family as this kind of ecosystem. And when one thing gets devastated, what happens to the rest of the ecosystem? So the boys are nowhere near home, and yet they are dramatically affected.
Yeah. Ricky is, he's taking a different direction, but yet a equally probably unhealthy long-term direction. He's fallen for his professor, and the professor's husband is kind of okay with that. Mm-hmm. We'll leave it at that, maybe.
Okay. But he also, you know, he got kind of boosted by his role as you know, the hero in that situation. And so all of his tentativeness as a student, when he goes back to school after what he perceived to be saving his father, his feet hit the ground, and he has this confidence, and his professor's like, what is this? You used to come to my office all the time and ask for advice. And, you know, she even imagines that maybe he's plagiarized his paper, but he's thinking, this is what it's like to go through life with self-confidence.
Hmm. My guest today is Mary Kay Zurovliff, whose third novel has just been published, Man Alive, a novel. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And she's an Oklahoma native, and she'll be coming back to Oklahoma for an appearance tonight, Booksmart Tulsa at Harwelden, in which there'll be, I believe, barbecue as Man Alive, the man alive in the story, is a psychotherapist who basically, once he's hit by lightning, says all he wants to do is barbecue. Now, how did you come up with the idea of barbecue of all the things you could have picked? I mean, you said that you were inspired by a man who wanted to play piano, but barbecue? I mean, it is kind of interesting because when you watch across cable television, it's like there are shows about barbecuing, and it's like, you know, barbecuing is like, you know, 8 hours of basically checking on it once an hour and rubbing it, spicing it, and keeping a low fire, and that's about all there is to it.
But
there are television shows about
that. I was going to say, let's go back to your phrase that there are television shows. There are people so obsessed with that. So it literally, first of all, I want to say that I'm reading with Rilla Askew and Connie Squires, two other wonderful, talented Oklahoma authors, so it should just be a blast. And secondly, the barbecue. People who, it really just came to me in my head, but it turned out to be a lucky choice. I mean, as you write and you research, you can change your choices, but sometimes the first impulse is reveals all sorts of exciting things. And the obsession around barbecue, there are contests, there are cook-offs, there are entire books just devoted, just as there are for cupcakes, there are for barbecue. And, you know, he's treating a lot of kids who have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and his attachment and devotion to barbecue goes right down that avenue.
I really found interesting Owen's sort of recovery process, because it literally is like his brain is resetting, and the way he would speak would be like a computer rebooting in many ways. Was there some medical background knowledge that helped you sort of construct the way he returned to himself?
Well, I guess, you know, you've read about it, and you've seen it, you've known people who have unfortunately had strokes or been hit by something and have to bring that speech back, and their pattern. So I did some research. I had unfortunately known people who had been through things like that. And his first impulse is mixed up with a lot of just, he will say anything to anyone, rude, crude, you know, no filter whatsoever. And, you know, that's another thing that he's always teaching the kids that he teaches, how to be
in control. Yeah, in mm-hmm. control. And mm-hmm. when you think about a therapist anyway, that's sort of like one of the ground rules, you know, be in control, you know, in control of yourself.
But also, you know, if you have kids, when they're 2 and 3 and 4 and they'll say to somebody, "You are fat," and you think, "Oh my God, I can't believe they said that." We don't say that to people. Well, she is fat. And, you know, we teach a kind of filtering that is not necessarily instinctive. And so a lot of what he's doing is going back to this primitive being. And then he's also asking himself, well, I don't know, should we call fat fat? Good question.
Well, he sounds like he was a wonderful character to write, to go through this process of. And what was the process like of creating this very in control guy who all of a sudden says, do I really need to be in control, as he's returning to faculties because he's had all these months where his brain is sort of getting back to normal, where he's like, well, you know, what are the consequences?
Yeah. And his children are thinking, oh my God, is this what he's going to be now? Just this free floating, like the yoga teacher down the street? Is that what my dad is going to be like? Because they're accustomed to him being, he has a very good reputation as a therapist, and he's considered sort of the wise, smart, forward-thinking guy who really knows what cocktail of medicines can bring these kids around in their stressful academic and social situations. And now, to revisit that, it shakes everybody up. He was a blast to write. I mean, there's a lot of talk right now about how much you have to love your characters or how much readers have to love your characters, and I think have is the wrong word. I think that for me, it's just an instinct. I create characters who I deeply love. I have to spend many years with them in the basement. So I might as well adore them. And then, unfortunately, I have to deliver trauma upon them, because a lot of our tension and drama and suspense is based around tribulation.
Now, there was a lot of funny lines in this book. You know, I remember Will thinking, you know, is he going to be a vegetable? Is he going to be you know, blah, blah, blah. Is he going to be a Republican?
That's not the dad he knew.
Yeah, exactly. And I was reading somewhere, you really don't consider yourself to be a comic novelist, but there's a lot of comedy in this. Is that just sort of your writing style?
Well, I've come around on this. I mean, it took me a while to sort of be able to articulate. My husband said, you don't take the label comic novelist, and yet you love it when someone says, I laughed out loud. You know, I woke up my wife because I was laughing as I was reading it, or I was on the subway and I actually laughed in front of everybody. Because when does someone make you laugh out loud by something you read? I mean, that seems to me a big compliment. And so as I've come to think of it, I think it is true that on any given day you have this insight, this thought of the sublime, just as you trip and fall on the trash can that you forgot you put out in the kitchen, and the dog throws up right after you've had this amazing insight into some other part of your life. And so the kind of ridiculous and sublime, that is life. That's not comedy. That's what happens to us. And so I was thinking about how we've done literature a disservice by dividing the world. You people get to look up, and then you people go for the slapstick. I'm not going for the slapstick. I'm going for right that sweet spot right in the middle where both are true.
Well, it's just like life, you know, even when life is, you're having a rough patch, you know, if you have that sense of humor about yourself in good times, it's still going to be there in bad times. Maybe it'll be a little more bitter, but mm-hmm. but it's still there. And that seems to be the tone of the novel. The novel, I mean, bad things are happening to this family, but it seems to be that things are still dealable, if you will. You know, if I'm
yeah, will the center hold is really the question. I mean, this family has been very tight, and they do share a lot of funny times, and they enjoy each other. Now, this is the biggest challenge they've ever faced. Is family going to be the thing that holds them together?
My guest today is Mary Kay Zoravlev. She is the author of Man Alive, a novel published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Follows a family after the patriarch of the family on their final day of vacation on the Delaware shore is struck by lightning as he's feeding a meter, of all things. And when he comes back to life, if you will, this very serious psychotherapist is all of a sudden consumed by barbecuing and putting out two turkeys on Thanksgiving. And it's a funny book, but it's also a serious book about a family. It's Man Alive. And this follows up on your previous book, The Bowl Is Already Broken, which before you started writing novels, you worked for the Smithsonian for a number of years. Is that right?
Yes, while I was writing. So I've always been writing, and I was finishing my first novel as I worked for years and years at the Sackler and Freer, which are the Asian art museums of the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. And that was a great job. So it was my job to make those exhibitions. The curators put them together, and I helped them with the language and any books we did or what they call ephemera, all the ephemera brochures you pick up. And that was a terrific job. And then I started writing a novel about an Asian art museum. And the day I left, the director said, "I understand you're on your second novel. Tell me it's not about a museum."
And in fact,
I looked
down
at the ground. He said, "Oh, Mary Kay, Mary Kay, Mary Kay."
Well, what about that job lend itself to a novel? Because, you know, we think of museums as being pretty buttoned-down places, but, of course, a lot of people do write about museums because they are interesting to us.
Well, in fact, we do. You see the outside. So this is behind the scenes, and I think of it as a love letter to museums. But, in fact, as somebody said, it might as well be mud wrestling what they're doing. I mean, how do these objects get up on these pedestals? And it's not always pretty. And there's a lot of politics behind it. And here's another. I must love people who are incredibly devoted to what they do. The people I worked with at the museum were like art nuns. I mean, they were so devoted to their topic. They were so smart, and they were just completely expert at what they did. And, you know, I just moved their words around on the page, but I wasn't the expert. And they would say, "Can you believe that you wake up in the morning and you get to come here?" Yeah, I can believe it. It's my job. Devotion really attracted me.
Well, and that devotion is, you know, any person in the art world, if they're working in that field, it's like there's that sort of sense of, I can't believe I'm able to actually hold that little Chinese bowl that I've read about or seen pictures of and studied so long to understand.
Well, and that's another thing, you know, hanging out at the Smithsonian. So I've edited for many of the museums and some of the smaller parts, subsets of the Smithsonian. And there's a line in the second novel, which somebody said to me, which is, "Never underestimate the power of the actual object." And, you know, people make this trek to see the ruby slippers. They make this trek to see the original, you know, Kermit the Frog. So what is that about, that we want to stand in front of the actual object, including Chinese screens and Japanese screens, and
or the beautiful peacock room there.
Oh, the peacock room,
which was made by Whistler.
Yes, and it's completely intact inside the Freer Museum of Art. So all of the shutters that he painted, and somebody else's leather that he completely painted over, he transformed someone's dining room a little more than they asked for.
It
was a commission, and he just took it over. And it's gorgeous, and it's there in its entirety. And so, again, when you stand inside it and you are there, what is that experience about? There's something transformative about it that's very exciting.
You mentioned earlier, you said, you know, you go down in your basement and write. And I understand some of these books have taken a long time. Or are they coming sooner now that you've given up your day gig?
This one went faster. Hallelujah. So, the second one took a long time. And, you know, life interrupts. The second novel, I had been writing for a while about a woman who was pregnant and didn't know she was pregnant. And then I realized I was pregnant and didn't know I was pregnant. And I had already had a kid, so I should have known better. And so my editor said to me, "You're the only woman I know who got pregnant by writing." So that sort of added a couple of years to the project. And, you know, then you have to stop and pay some bills. And so I would take various freelance jobs or actual office jobs to keep the engine going and then be able to come back to it. So, you know, novels are protracted projects, and you just have to hope that you care enough about them to get to the end times, actually.
Yeah. Earlier you were saying that you thought this would be a short story before it became a novel. What are the things that go into a decision where a story ostensibly about this therapist who is struck by lightning all of a sudden becomes a family drama of the whole family and a novel.
Every question you've asked. I mean, that's what happens. So if it's just Owen's story and he has this aberration and he is healing from it, and you end with him wondering if, you know, how much do I want to get back to normal? Okay, that's a short story, right? This extraordinarily painful experience hit him, but he had a different reaction. So you've made not the familiar, but you've made something fresh out of that. But the second I started asking myself, well, what about Will? What about Ricky? What about Brooke? What about his wife? And how long would this take? And how? Then I had to have these other threads going on, and it was much, much more than a 20-page story.
Mm. Well, it's a wonderful book, Man Alive, a novel. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Now, are you hard at work on another novel at this point, or what's going on in your writing life today other than promoting this book?
Well, I have started another book, and I have unfortunately shelved it just for a little bit. You have to really promote the book that is just out. But I'm gathering information, and the next novel has a little bit more of Oklahoma in it. So it's a good thing I'm here.
Really? So now, you grew up here, but you left at college. Is Oklahoma, you know, you're going to be reading with Rilla Askew, who says, you know, she's lived everywhere else, but Oklahoma's always been the thing she's written about. Has that ever been a theme in your writings, even short stories or things like that?
Yeah, I've written some short stories and you know, the Rattlesnake Roundup, and I wrote a story about that. And then in my second novel, the main character who I was talking about, Promise, who is pregnant and doesn't know she's pregnant, she's from Oklahoma, and now she's at the Smithsonian, and she's a Persian art expert of manuscripts illuminated of Rumi's poetry. And she keeps thinking, how did I get from here to here, the amazing paths that we take? And her mother comes to visit her at one point when she's going to have the new baby and things are kind of out of control. And her mother comes, and her mother's from Oklahoma and has all sorts of different attitudes than they have in Washington. And, you know, the museum's in danger, and the mother says, well, maybe the museum's run its course. And, you know, Promise can't even wrap her mind around that. And so that was an exciting episode to weave in some different kind of attitudes. When you're in a certain world, you sometimes can't see outside that world. So to bring in a different sensibility, I brought the Oklahoma grandma in.
Well, that is from The Bowl Is Already Broken, your previous novel. The new novel is titled Man Alive, a novel. And we wish you great success with it. And we'll look forward to that next book whenever it comes out about Oklahoma. Mary Kay Zarabov, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Mary Kay Zarabov's new novel is titled Man Alive. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. She'll be a guest tonight of Book Smart Tulsa for a Book Smart Tulsa barbecue. It takes place at 6 o'clock tonight at Harwell, and she'll be reading from her new novel, as well as writers Rilla Askew and Constance Squires will be reading from their work as well. Again, the event is tonight at 6 o'clock at Harwell, and you can learn more at booksmarttulsa.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.